Thanks for joining us for Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the show we're talking about the Utah response to the revised GOP health care initiative, about Senator Orrin Hatch's comments on Donald Trump Jr. Russia story, also about the ballot initiative to increase education funding, and a good deal more. Joining me for this conversation today, Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Courtney Tanner. Good morning, and thanks for being here, Courtney.
Good morning.
Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr is on the phone with us. Welcome, Tommy. Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
And rounding out the group here in the studio is columnist Robert Gerke. Thanks, Robert, for being here.
Thank you.
We also welcome your thoughts during this Friday morning news wrap-up. You can weigh in with your questions and comments at sltrib.com or post them to the KCPW Facebook page, or you can call us up. We are at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Let's begin with the latest on health care. And Courtney Tanner, GOP senators unveiled a new draft of their bill just a couple of days ago. Proposals have to walk a fine line to please the various factions. Someone who has not been on board with this overhaul is Utah Senator Mike Lee. What does he think of this new version of the bill, Courtney?
So the latest from Mike Lee is that he's withholding judgment. He had kind of made these pledges that he'd vote for the bill if you include this amendment, if you include this provision. And so those were included in the bill. But yesterday he still said, I'm going to read it. I'm going to study it. I'm still not sure where I'm going to vote.
Okay. Had he not seen the bill as of yesterday, or was it just that he just hadn't had time to read it yet?
He saw it for the first time yesterday, according to him. He held an online town hall where he said that he hadn't seen it yet and was kind of worried about not being able to read it before a vote.
Isn't he on the committee that drafted this bill? And why has he not been sort of included in that process, if that's the case?
He said that the GOP leadership has kind of written the bill without this working group of 15 senators that were supposed to be drafting it.
You mentioned those two amendments that he has that he wanted to see included. Tell us what they were and whether or not they've been included in this new bill.
So the first amendment that Lee wanted to see is something he drafted with Senator Ted Cruz of Texas. It's the consumer freedom option. It allows insurance companies to offer these kind of cheaper, less comprehensive plans, as long as they offer something that's compliant with Obamacare as well. And that was included. Senator Lee said that something based on it was, so he kind of hedged a little. It's not his exact language, but it's the same concept.
And so something that's compliant would be, so you'd have different versions. You'd have one, you'd have plans that were available. The way that this has been sort of analyzed in the media, at least, is that you have some plans that are offered that are cheaper for healthier, younger people, and then one plan maybe that is compliant with Obamacare and therefore is more expensive for older people or less healthy people. Is that right?
That's kind of the point. So the one plan that's compliant with Obamacare has to offer coverage for pre-existing conditions. So you're going to have a lot of people with specialized medical needs going to that plan, which is going to drive up premium costs, according to a lot of experts and insurance companies.
Okay. So just to get back to it, does this new version of the bill, does that satisfy his amendments? Does it include his desires for health care?
It has what he said that he wanted to see in the bill. There's a provision that says you can use your health savings account to pay for premiums, and it has this amendment that he wanted, but he's still kind of standing back saying, I'm not going to tell you whether I'm going to vote for it. And the bill's kind of teetering on the edge anyway. There's a lot of Republicans who have either said they're not going to vote for it or don't want to even go to a debate on the bill. So it's not like his support is going to make or break this just yet. It's already teetering.
Already teetering. How about Senator Utah Senator Orrin Hatch? What does he say about this new, revised proposal, I guess is the way to put it? And what has his role been when it comes to the whole repeal and replace effort, if we can still call it that?
Hatch has been on board from the beginning. He said some kind of interesting comments yesterday saying that this new version is far from perfect, but he encouraged his colleagues to get on board and to vote for this bill because he says, it's not going to get better. It's complex. This is kind of, we need to do the art of the doable is kind of his phrase.
Okay. And I don't know if this is a question for you or for Tommy Burr, but has the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, weighed in on this? Or when will that happen?
They're expected to weigh in early next week. They've got both a draft with the kind of Mike Lee, Ted Cruz amendment and a draft without. So those scores should come out early of the week.
Okay. Why is it being done that way? Why scoring two versions of the bill? Is that, It won't just one version of that bill actually make it into the vote? And so why would they go through the process of scoring two separate versions of the bill?
I think the point is to kind of say, you know, did this amendment really help? You know, are more people going to be insured under this version versus that version? And they can kind of weigh, you know, the effects of the provisions there.
Yeah. It's fairly common when they have major amendments that make significant changes to a bill for them to score both the bill and the amendments, and so they can kind of get an idea of what the impact of either version of the bill would end up looking like.
And that's Robert Gerke. I want to bring Thomas Burr in Washington in on all of this. Do we know, Tommy, when a vote on this might happen, and will it ever happen if there isn't enough support, or will it get sent back to, you know, the meat grinder for further
work? That's a good question. They're planning a vote. The problem is it doesn't seem like they can even get to the final passage. The situation right now is they don't even have enough votes to get to the final passage. So at the moment, you have people like Dean Heller of Nevada, Mike Lee, not sure they're going to even vote to proceed to the final passage. So they're planning next week. Waiting on CBO score. When we get there, it's a question of even if they can get to pass that one little hurdle, even to get to a vote. And at the moment, they don't have it. The Republicans hold 52 seats. They control the Senate, but they can't pass their own bill at the moment.
Hmm. Do we know? I guess, Courtney, you kind of addressed this, but how overall this is going to affect premiums? I mean, we mentioned that split between younger and older people. Is that sort of the only analysis we've had so far, or? How will this affect premiums? And Tommy, that might be a question for you.
That looks to be the case. So it looks like premiums for people with pre-existing conditions are going to rise. People that are older are going to go to these more specialized plans. So that risk pool is all going to be, you know, sicker individuals. And then it's going to kind of segregate out the healthy people will go to cheaper plans.
There's also provisions in the bill, in the both the previous version of the Senate bill and the current version, that significantly reduce the subsidies that are available. And so the Kaiser Family Foundation looked at what the impact would be on a county-by-county basis, age group, economic breakdown. And especially for older people who were receiving subsidies before, they're going to see their out-of-pocket premiums almost double. You know, we're talking about a $4,000+ increase in what they're going to be paying out of pocket for this. There's also provisions in there that actually are going to be reducing, they're going to be capping the subsidies at a lower point, which is to say, right now, if you go onto the exchange, you can order a silver plan. Mm-hmm. The silver plan is sort of the medium plan. You have bronze, silver, and gold. They're going to start capping the premiums or the subsidies at bronze level, which is it's not a very good plan. It's got a much higher deductible. The deductible is about $6,600, I think, for one of these plans. And so what we're seeing then is we're going to be paying more for less insurance. There's going to be less government help for these people who are on the exchange. And then you tack on, as Courtney mentioned, with the Lee Amendment, where you're going to be pushing the sicker people into a separate risk pool where their premiums are going to be driven up even more. The healthier people, yeah, they can stay on these crappy insurance plans and pay less money. But the health insurance companies are saying that this is going to skew basically destroy the entire concept of having these risk pools. It's going to skew the market and really do a number on premiums for a lot of people.
Just going to the back to the presidential campaign, wasn't a sort of campaign promise of the president's to lower health care costs for individuals? And that might be doing this for the healthy population to a certain extent. But overall, is that being done here?
No. I guess it's maybe like Obama said, if you like your plan, you can keep it. It wasn't true. They can't do it. And so now we're, you know, because what they're trying to do is they still have significant tax breaks in this bill. And so if you're trying to cut spending, that money's got to come out of somewhere. And where they're taking it out of is the assistance they're giving to, you know, older and lower income and frail people.
Tommy Burr, President Obama spent a lot of his political capital to get the Affordable Care Act passed. Is President Trump anywhere to be seen in this process for this overhaul?
You mean other than a few tweets? No. The answer is, it doesn't seem like the White House is involved in this at all. Pretty much they've left the Senate draft their own and discover what they want to write. I asked Senator Hatch about that this week, whether he thinks that the president could do more, and he's like, no, we've got it, pretty much. And I think in some Republicans' minds, it's probably best that the president doesn't get involved. But no, he's this is the Senate bill. This has nothing to do with the White House.
Hmm. You know, just Courtney, actually, before I forget about this, Mike Lee during his town hall made some comments talking about his not necessarily about his amendment, but he made a parallel between health care and car insurance. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So he said that Obamacare is similar to car insurance if, you know, you had a car insurance rate that was the same for exactly everyone, no matter how many accidents you'd been in, no matter, like, how good of a driver you were. And so he was kind of denigrating that, like, you know, to make fun of Obamacare. But then he kind of walks it back a little and he goes, you know, health insurance and car insurance are different things, and you can choose not to drive, but you need health care. And so he kind of hedged it. But, yeah, he made that comparison.
I want to know if Robert Gricke can draw a line between Lee talking about safe older drivers and the full page ad in the Tribune with pictures of older Utah state lawmakers that called him out for being impaired. Just kidding.
Yeah.
You don't have to do it. But I do want to turn to you, columnist Robert Gricke. I think I've asked you this question a few times during previous iterations of this bill already, but this was a campaign talking point, not just for President Trump, the mm-hmm. repeal and replace effort. But it turns out that that is no easy task. Is that because there are just too many vested interests now, too many people benefiting from the current system, or why can't the Republicans seem to get a sort of coalition together on this?
Well, as Courtney mentioned, Senator Lee's town hall the other night, he did come back over and over again to say that Republicans have campaigned on this issue and we won the election based on this issue, and this is what people have sent us back there to do. Unfortunately for him, the polls indicate the otherwise, that people actually now quite like Obamacare. A lot of people are benefiting from it. The prospect of having 22 to 23 million people suddenly losing their health insurance and then beginning, you know, getting sick and not having any options available is not something that people are too keen on. And so, and if you're Mitch McConnell right now, you're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place where you're trying to appease the Senator Lees and Ted Cruz's of the world, but you've also got to keep the John McCain's and Susan Collins happy. And so he maybe got, you know, Ted Cruz and Mike Lee on board now. Perhaps, we don't know that for sure yet, but he still hasn't got Susan Collins and John McCain and some of the other moderates, Dean Heller, as Tommy mentioned.
Well, he definitely has Ted Cruz on board. We're waiting to see about.
We're
Mike
waiting
Lee.
To see yeah. about Mike Lee.
But
exactly.
then factions within the party, or is it sort of people responding to their constituents?
Well, you start losing the moderates, yeah, and so John McCain, in particular, for example, the governor Governor Ducey in Arizona had some concerns about the version of the Republican bill that was initially released. He had things that he wanted to see that would have helped protect, I guess, Arizona's Medicaid program. Those weren't in the bill. And so McCain says, I'm still not supporting this, and if we keep pushing forward with it, I'm not going to vote for it. Mm-hmm. You know, and Susan Collins is sort of the same boat. She, you know, because people in these states have benefited from it. States have made decisions on expanding Medicaid based on the assurances from the federal government, and now to try to pull those out from under those states, they're not keen on that, and it doesn't play well at the local level. And people like Dean Heller, for example, are going to be up for election, and you know, it's in Nevada in particular, a purple state, right? It could go either way, and a lot of people have benefited from it, and he doesn't want to do anything to undermine that.
How has this played out here in Utah? I mean, we're a state that didn't expand Medicaid, for example. We don't stand to lose that. Are Utahns, you know, how are they being politically sort of involved in this? Do they care that much about this proposal?
I think they do. I think because we've had almost 200,000 people sign up for health care through the exchanges since they were created, and so those people are going to be directly impacted, as we mentioned, by the reduction in the subsidies, by the increasing in the premiums, by the reduction in the benefits, by potentially, if the Lee Amendment goes through, the you know, elimination of some pre-existing conditions and things like that. So yeah, I mean, you know, there are people that are going to be impacted. They're trying to make their voices heard. I spoke with one woman who called into Senator Lee's conference call, and her point was that when her husband got sick, they didn't have insurance, and he couldn't afford to go to the doctor, and so he put it off, and he put it off, and he put it off until until when he went, he was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer. He died in 2006. And she said, we can't go back to that time when people couldn't afford to get treated for when they got sick. And so so they're trying to make their voices heard. You know, with Senator Lee and Senator Hatch, again, I'm sure they've heard these stories before, and it would appear that they don't necessarily care, that they feel it's more important to, you know, repeal Obamacare than it is to kind of keep serving their constituents. Hmm.
Tommy Burr in Washington, is there a vote scheduled for this bill? Or maybe that's a question for Courtney. And is it going to, I guess you can't predict whether or not it's going to happen, but is there a vote scheduled and when? Nobody knows.
that's pretty much the answer. the plan is next week, but nobody knows. I mean, Mitch McConnell's sitting there trying to, tally up 50 votes to get it to actually the final passage, and that includes the Vice President, Mike Pence, actually coming in to kind of break that tie. But at the moment, they're really struggling, and this is, again, this is something Republicans have campaigned on for 7 years. The President keeps saying that they're going to get it done, but he's not involved at all. So this is a really struggle for Senate leadership.
You know, we need to go to a break here, but just before we do, if this doesn't get a vote, or if it goes back to sort of being redrawn in committee, will it come back again, or is that sort of the end of this?
I can't imagine that the voters are going to accept the we gave it a shot attitude. So they're definitely going to keep trying, but I would hate to be a Republican senator going back home in August after promising for 7 years they're going to repeal Obamacare and not having done anything.
Well, if I could just jump in real quick, maybe this failing would probably be the best thing that could happen, right? Because then the Republicans have to go back to the drawing board and actually include members of the other party, you know, be more inclusive in the way they do this instead of drawing a bill up behind closed doors that they think they can get 50 votes for. And then falling short, maybe they actually start including other people's ideas and focusing on fixing the problems instead of trying to pass a partisan Obamacare repeal.
Columnist Robert Gerke's advice to the Senate.
They should listen to me.
Guys, I want to move on from healthcare, but first we do need to take a quick break. When we return, we'll look at reaction to the meeting between Donald Trump Jr. and a Russian lawyer. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Back after this short break.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr, government reporter Courtney Tanner, Tribune columnist Robert Gerke, and joining us right now, education reporter Benjamin Wood. Ben, thanks for being here as well.
Happy to be here.
We're discussing this past week's news, and we welcome your questions and comments at either sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page. You can also simply call us up at 801-355-8255. Tommy Burr, in the nation's capital, you covered this week the fallout to revelations about a meeting between the president's son and a Russian lawyer. That meeting took place during the presidential campaign last year, and I want to talk about the fallout, but maybe you could actually just first remind us how this story came to light, because how that happened is kind of interesting. Tell us that story.
It is. It's one of those, I guess we're getting more used to it here in Washington, but, this drip, drip, drip of the Russian stuff coming out is just fascinating, shocking, surprising every step of the way. The New York Times has been on this for a while, and it literally came out in just days of, I think Saturday's first story. Trump Jr. had a meeting with a Russian lawyer. He played it off as, we wanted to talk about, Russian adoptions. Long story short, essentially, we have some sanctions against human abuse people. People have been convicted of human abuse in Russia, and so therefore they can't come to the United States. Therefore, they say we can't adopt Russian children. He says that's what the meeting was about. Then it goes to, there's an email chain that shows there were some problems. There was a meeting that they were trying to set up. Long story short, it comes down to right before the New York Times publishes a story email showing that Trump Jr. had agreed to this meeting. Trump Jr. releases this email chain, just puts it out on Twitter to everyone in the world, pretty much saying, though, it was saying the email was literally, the Russian government wants to help your father. We have some incriminating information about Hillary Clinton. Would you meet with us? Wow. And he took the meeting.
And saying that it was the Russian government who had this information. And part of the story is that this lawyer allegedly has connections to the Kremlin, to the government, that essentially she was working for the Russian government. Is there any confirmation there, or is that just sort of speculation? Why do we think that? Just because of the language in the email?
Yeah, and then the Trump White House is playing this off as that, you know, the meeting was really nothing, that nothing actually happened. They edited it was only 20 minutes, and there was no information exchanged. They didn't have anything. But what was promised in the email exchange was literally the Russian lawyer, the Russian government essentially has information to help you win the election, and would you meet with us? And the Trump Jr.'s response was, "I love it."
Right. Utah Senator Orrin Hatch weighed in on this, and what did he have to say about this news?
You should have seen the scrum around Orrin Hatch when I grabbed him in the Senate on Tuesday. It was insane about how many reporters were standing there. He says it's completely overblown. He very much defended Trump Jr. as an honorable person, a great kid. He said a very interesting thing. I don't think I actually put this in my story, but he's like, Trump divorced their mother and they still love him still, which I found a very odd comment at the time. But he said Trump Jr. is a very bright man. He's very nice. And this is just all overblown.
A reporter did ask him if he would have taken a meeting himself with a Russian operative for dirt on an opponent. And what did Hatch have to say about that?
Yeah, I was standing right there, and that was interesting. He said no and then laughed. So he personally would not have taken the meeting, apparently. Hmm.
Hatch was also particularly critical of Democratic Senator Tim Kaine, who reacted pretty strongly to the Trump Jr. story himself. What did Tim Kaine say, and how did Hatch respond?
So Tim Kaine, of course, everyone remembers, was Hillary Clinton's running mate to be vice president. He said, this is beyond obstruction of justice. This is moving into perjury, false statements, and even to potentially treason. Hatch was not having any of that. Said, "You've got to be kidding. That kind of language should never be used." I talked to Congressman Chris Stewart about that as well. Stewart's on the House Intelligence Committee.
Right.
He called that entirely premature to even be talking and using the T word.
Okay. Let's bring Robert Gerke, columnist, in, the opinion columnist. Give us your opinion of the use of the word treason and when it might be appropriate. Is never an accurate one, but maybe you can talk a little bit about the fallout from these.
I think in my column about it, I called it light treason, which I think was a reference to Arrested Development. I don't know if you watch that show, but I think these emails are a bombshell, a huge bombshell, as I said, and it's kind of changed everything, because before there was always this sort of plausible deniability where they could say, well, we didn't know the Russian government was trying to help us win the election. Here we have in writing an email that says the Russian government wants to help you win the election, and that their response was, "I love it. Let's have a meeting." And so, there's now no pretense that they didn't know that the Russian government was trying to work to their advantage. Now, does that make collusion? Well, it's getting pretty close. It's a lot harder to kind of pretend that that Russia was operating on its own without any knowledge of the campaign when you have the campaign manager, the candidate's son, and another high-ranking advisor all sitting in this meeting agreeing to take this meeting with this attorney who, as the email represented, is working on behalf of the Russian government. So, I think this is a huge milestone in this whole entire investigation, and I think the president, now we ask questions about what did the president know, when did he know it, and what did he do about it. And those are questions I think he's got to answer, and he's got to answer them soon.
Thomas Burr, special.
Can I jump in?
Sure, please.
One other thing we need to add, and this is kind of breaking news in the last hour. This happened. I think it was NBC News reporting that one of the other people in the meeting with Don Jr., Paul Manafort, who was the campaign manager, Jared Kushner's son-in-law of the president. This Russian lawyer was another person who was a former Russian spy. Literally a former Russian spy was in this meeting.
We might as well have Boris Badenov and Natasha in there with, like they're going to plotting to get the moose and squirrel. That's a Bullwinkle reference for the children listening at home.
We got it. Thomas Burr, you know, there's a special counsel. This is Robert Mueller, former FBI director, who's been looking quietly, apparently, at the Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. Will this meeting fall within the scope of that investigation?
I don't think there's any question about that. In fact, they've already, I'm sure, put out some subpoenas or looking for, you know, they're getting the actual documents on this one. The thing with Mueller investigation is it's going to take time, and this is not something you should expect any resolution in the next month or so. These guys are going to you know, dot the I's and cross the T's and take their time. But I think there's already been the House Intelligence Committee and the Senate Intelligence Committee definitely want to question Donald Trump Jr. And the other people who apparently were in the meeting. This is definitely on their scope.
And I'll just point out, and this has been pointed out in other media outlets, that within hours of Trump Jr. agreeing to take this meeting, his dad was on the campaign stand saying that there were going to be major revelations about Hillary Clinton's criminal conduct in the coming days. And so, you know, we haven't connected those dots, but there's some pretty big dots there that aren't that far apart.
How big is this? You know, I want to turn to actually local election stories, but how big of an impact is this, all of this stuff, the Russia story, having on the president's ability to move forward with an agenda, Tommy?
You know, it seems he can't focus on other things in some ways. The stories coming out of the White House are that he's enraged about the media coverage, not about what his son may have done, but about the coverage. And he continually tweets about it. He can't get over it. This is really sucking up a lot of the oxygen inside the White House, it appears. And we just discussed, the White House really isn't involved in the healthcare debate right now. They're really focused on the Russian fallout.
Does this have any, you know, I'm thinking, so we're going to turn to the special election that's here happening in Utah's 3rd Congressional District. Does any of what's happening in the White House have any bearing on, you know, the GOP in individual states, like the Utah GOP? Is there any kind of effect? Maybe that's a question for Robert Gierke, actually.
Well, that's an interesting question because it's kind of hard to, we haven't seen Democrats punch through and win a special election yet based on Trump's unpopularity. And so I'm not sure that we're there yet. Now, I do know that you mentioned our 3rd District special election that we've got right now. Chris Harrod spent a fair amount of time in Russia. He taught there for a period of time, and he uses Russia as this sort of, you know, the evil empire kind of caricature that that Ronald Reagan maybe did. And so he's running very much against Russia, and at a time when Russia's looming large on our domestic, you know, our domestic political stage. So it could be an issue there, but it's not like there are people on the other side saying, well, that we need to buddy up to them and be their pals, you
right.
know. So
more of talking points than having a big impact. Let's turn to that special election, though, now, because Courtney Tanner, you have been following this. I know that we've got a primary election coming up on the Republican side. Primary election. Yeah, thanks. That's the word I'm looking for. And then the actual election in November. And let's talk about the candidates who are running on the GOP side. They had their first debate this week, and I won't ask you if there was a winner because that's not your job. But was there any wide difference of opinion on matters of policy between the candidates?
No, so there are three Republican candidates. There's Provost Mayor John Curtis, former state rep Chris Harrod, and investment advisor Tanner Ainge, who's kind of a newcomer. And every single question in this debate, they all kind of gave just like reiterations of the same answer. You know, they asked about federal government. Everyone said it should be limited. They asked about tax increases. Everybody said there shouldn't be any. They asked about Obamacare. Everyone said they should repeal it.
Your description of the event, the lead of your article, actually was pretty funny. You said that the debate was as civil and courteous as an afternoon tea party. they really do just all hold roughly the same positions on all of the things that they discussed during this debate.
Yeah, so the debate focused more on economics, and their kind of argument after the debate, the candidates' argument, was that, you know, economics we all agree on, but if you had asked about maybe immigration, maybe there would have been some difference there.
They could have distinguished themselves. I'm going to remind listeners that you can call us at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255 to join this conversation. And Courtney, there weren't just Republicans on the stage at this debate, correct?
Yes, there was the Libertarian, Joe Buckman, and then a candidate from the Independent American Party, Jason Christensen.
Okay. Originally, though, this had been slated to be a just Republican debate.
Well, they had invited Kathy Allen, who's the Democrat So the organization, Americans for Prosperity Utah, says, you know, we invited her, she didn't respond. But Kathy Allen says, you know, I never got this invitation. You guys didn't actually invite me.
Okay. Well, you know, there's been some polling done in this race, especially on the GOP side, a Utah policy poll from Dan Jones and Associates. And this was early in the week. But what did polling at that time show among these three Republican candidates?
The poll shows that Provo Mayor John Curtis is ahead. But, you know, there's a 7% mark with the margin of error there. And 49% of respondents said they were undecided. Wow. So it's still anyone's game, really.
A lot of times in these polls, when people are undecided going into a primary, they don't vote, so they don't actually have an impact on the outcome. So I think it's probably good news for the Curtis campaign that he's ahead. I think the outcome of the debate, in as much as there wasn't any, he didn't screw up, he didn't fall down, and none of the other candidates actually drew blood, was probably good news for him. I think he's probably still the front runner right now.
Does that have anything to do with you know, the way in which people actually got, the route in which people got onto the ballot? Because you had, you know, the person getting anointed kind of at the convention, mm-hmm. who gets, and then you have the others who are getting signatures. There has been this kind of war going on within the party. Maybe that's overstating it, but there's been a split in the Republican Party.
No, there definitely has. Between the diehards, the delegates who go to the conventions, and the sort of the mainstream Republican voters. The diehards who go to the convention are the people who are also going to vote in the primary. They think they're the most motivated voters, and they're the ones who are going to come out and vote for Chris Herod. But keep in mind, I mean, John Curtis did very badly at the convention. And so I think this shows this, again, the dichotomy between the delegates and how they view issues, and how they support somebody who is a strident partisan on the right wing of the party in Chris Herod, especially on immigration's issues like immigration. And then how, you know, the more mainstream Republicans appear, you know, to be headed toward somebody like John Curtis, who has a reputation, at least, for being a moderate. And you know, he's got some good news recently. Provo won some more accolades in the media about being a good place to do business and so forth. So yeah, I think it does show that there's a disparity or discrepancy in the way that the delegates and the way the voters approach these elections.
Well, Courtney Tanner mentioned Kathy Allen, the Democrats' candidate, and she's got a big fundraising lead. She raised a bunch of money to try and unseat Jason Chaffetz before he announced that he was retiring. Does that fundraising lead, is that going to help her? I mean, I guess the traditionally this district has not been a place where Democrats have fared all that well. Is the money that she has going to count for something, Robert Gerke?
We've talked about it here, that this is one of the most Republican-leaning districts in the country. And, you know, while she's able to raise a lot of money to run against this sort of boogeyman in Jason Chaffetz, now that he's off the scene, it's kind of hard to see that momentum necessarily continues in terms of the outpouring of support.
Would she have fared better against Jason Chaffetz?
Probably not.
Okay.
But we have seen, I guess, in the Georgia special election and some other special elections, that the national interests continue to pour money in if they see there's an opportunity for her, for a Democratic candidate to break through. So what she's got to do is she's got to get out there and make sure that she can, between now and the primary, that she can actually make this look like a viable race. Then maybe the money continues to pour in. But it's hard to see that this is going to end up being a Democratic upset.
I want to turn to education stories here in a moment and leave politics behind. But Tommy Berwick, since I've got you on the line from Washington, just quickly before we go to another break, has Jason Chaffetz has left Congress. Has he made his debut on Fox News, and how did that go?
Yes, he has. He's been appearing every couple days on Fox and Friends and other shows. And then he's the same old Jason Chaffetz. I think you see the same. He's critical of Democrats and... He's not so critical of the White House, though he's not necessarily defending the White House. In some ways, I think you just have the same guy on TV. He's just now a former congressman.
Okay. Well, on the sidelines, though, and maybe now able to speak his mind in a way that he might not have done as a candidate or as a political office holder.
Yes, but making a lot more money. That's for sure.
Right. Well, we'll see what happens with his now vacant seat in a couple of months' time. Right now, though, we've got to take another quick break. When we return, the Our Schools Now Ballot Initiative's Roadshow. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public, joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Benjamin Wood, Courtney Tanner, Robert Gerke, and Thomas Burr. Call us with your comments and questions. We are at 801-355-TALK. Benjamin Wood, education reporter. For a few months now, we've been hearing about the ballot initiative that aims to increase funding for education here in Utah. The organizers of that initiative took their show on the road this past week for a series of town halls, trying to generate support for their effort. How did that go for them?
By all accounts, it went. These meetings were kind of the last procedural hurdle before they are able to begin gathering signatures.
These are required.
Yeah, okay. These are required meetings in seven regions of the state. And now that they've checked that box, they're free to go and start knocking on your door with clipboards and getting your name to try and qualify for the ballot.
Has that happened? Are people out there knocking on doors now?
They say they're going to start in August. And so, you know, they're regrouping. They're listening to the feedback they received at these meetings. There obviously is an apparatus to get going, but yeah, I mean, in the coming weeks, they should be out in force.
Remind us who is behind this initiative. Some big Utah names.
Some big names: Scott Anderson, Zions Bank CEO; Gail Miller of the Utah Jazz; Ron Gibson; Bob Marquardt; various entities from the Chambers of Commerce and business leaders, and kind of the who's who of Utah's business community, with most education groups in tow.
You at one of these town halls you described in your article, there was some criticism for these organizers, for just essentially for being who they were, but also criticism of the very notion of public education at some of these town halls.
Yeah, and looking at these meetings, I decided to go down to the one in Orem, where I assumed the kind of conservative fervor would make for a more interesting discussion. And the room was pretty evenly split. A lot of educators came out to voice their support, and then at the same time, there were a lot of everyday taxpayers that were worried about the cost, as well as your kind of classic public school opponent who were, decrying socialism and, the overreach of the federal government and indoctrination of our children. So, you just kind of get a little bit of everything at these meetings, from the supporters to the critics of the very concept of public education.
Well, you mentioned the support expressed from more than one educator who say that this is money badly needed. As we know, Utah is one of the lowest per pupil spenders in the country. I guess also you mentioned taxpayers. The Utah Taxpayers Association was present. This is a group that you would think would generally be against raising taxes for any purpose. But from what I read in your article, it seemed that they had Billy Hesterman and Senator Howard Stevenson there. And while they had some problems with the initiative, from the quotes I read, it didn't seem like they were exactly opposed to it.
Yeah, I mean, in the last few years, the Taxpayers Association and Howard Stevenson, in particular Senator Howard Stevenson, they've really become focused on this idea of funding equity. And this idea that in Park City, the tiniest fraction of a tax increase generates millions of dollars for the school district, whereas down in Tintic or Tooele, they just have to scrimp and save for every last dollar. And so you see the Taxpayers Association where, they still are skeptical and critical of tax increases in general, but more and more they've become focused on this idea of fairness in taxation and how some districts just have a leg up compared to others. And so Howard, Senator Stevenson, he spoke about how, if we are to do this push for a tax increase, he'd like to see some sort of equalization, some formula where Park City might not get as much help as Tooele.
Based maybe on population of students.
Yeah, population of students, as well as just overall property values, tax yields. There's actually a few formulas out there, bills that have been run. Senator Fillmore had a bill last year that looked to kind of slice off a piece of education funding and just start filling in the bottom of the taxation scale until the districts start to level out. So there are some proposals out there. Our schools now does not do that. And when I've asked them, they've said that, with a ballot initiative, you have to keep it simple. I mean, you have to put a paragraph.
Yes or no.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it has to come down to a pretty easy question. But that is part of the conversation out there, this idea of should we be putting more money towards poor districts and let districts like Salt Lake and Park City fend for themselves?
Ben, if I could, do you get the impression that they're going to make any changes to the initiative based on what they heard from these listening sessions, or you think they're pretty well, the cement is dry?
I think the cement is drying. You know, they made some changes between their announcement and when they filed the paperwork with the elections office. They brought in the sales tax. They lowered their increase a little bit. You know, it's certainly possible, and they have the ability to make some changes. But the sense that I'm getting is that they've kind of latched onto their plan, this 0.5% income and sales tax, and they're moving forward.
Columnist Robert Gerke, this is as the ballot initiative stands. Utah's had some I don't know if trouble is the right word, but they haven't funded education to the extent that some proponents would like. Is this ballot initiative the way to address that?
Well, I think it's a reflection of the fact that the legislature, despite all that they say they've done, has not there's a perception in the business community and among the public at large that they haven't done enough. And so this is really the only way for voters to take this into their own hands. The Chamber of Commerce types, the business leaders say that they're having a hard time finding a qualified workforce, and so that's the way they're going. And so the legislature, is never going to raise taxes. I mean, let's rephrase that. They raise taxes fairly often, but they're not going to raise taxes for education. And so this was the only option that was left for them, and so here we are. A ballot initiative is a hard thing to accomplish in this state. The legislature's made it very difficult to get these passed, but I think this one obviously is well funded by as Ben mentioned, the people that are involved in it. And it is, when you do the polling, is one of the top issues that the public feels the most strongly about in poll after poll.
You mentioned the barriers to the ballot initiative. That's a difficult process to go through. Do lawmakers, this is kind of an obvious question, but do they dislike the idea of ballot initiatives generally, just sort of on principle, because it takes lawmaking out of
their hands? They hate it. They like to have the control over how the money's spent, where the money comes from, what the policy decisions are, and they feel like anything that voters do is a usurpation of that authority that they've got. And so, they've made it very difficult for that purpose to get these ballot initiatives passed. And in the past, when they've had ballot initiatives that have passed, they've often gone back and kind of tinkered with them after the fact. I'm thinking of there was a term limits ballot initiative several years ago, and it got on the ballot. The legislature passed term limits and said, "Look, we don't need the ballot initiative anymore." The ballot initiative failed, and then 8 years later, before the term limits kicked in and actually term limited anybody out, they went back and repealed it. So they've kind of played these cynical games with ballot initiatives in the past. I think you could also point to Count My Vote as one that they've kind of tried to mess with, and their actions have sort of derailed the initiatives in the past.
Well, there are several that are out there right now. Mm-hmm. Ben, again, you said that the signature gathering effort for the Our Schools Now initiative is going to start in August. Do we know what their sort of strategy for gathering signatures are? Is it paid people going door to door?
You know, we don't know much about that yet. But this is a group that has no shortage of volunteers. I mean, just the fact that they were able to hold these 7 meetings simultaneously from Logan to St. George, I mean, they are not wanting for people who are eager and willing to participate. You know, the man who moderated the meeting in Orem, he was just a volunteer. He wasn't part of the campaign. He wasn't a member of the Chamber of Commerce. And, we saw Ron Gibson and Bob Marquardt driving out to St. George, taking these meetings on the road. I mean, so I would imagine there will be several different efforts simultaneously, I would bet, but this is not a group that is going to be wanting for.
If I could jump in there real quick,
I think
Ben's absolutely right. When you have a structure, when you've got thousands of teachers around the state who are willing to put their, to walk neighborhoods and knock on doors and do this, they've got to build in infrastructure. We saw when they did the referendum to repeal the vouchers, they gathered those signatures in no time, and I think that they'll kind of do the same thing again. If they need to go in and provide some assistance with paid signature gatherers, they're going to have the money to do that too. I think they made an interesting strategic decision in holding the 7 meetings simultaneously, because otherwise you're going to have the same group of opponents going from meeting to meeting to meeting, making a ruckus about how they don't want this. You hold them all 7 together, and you have this overwhelming number of teachers coming out as supporters, and you spread out the opposition. And so I think that was part of the strategic decision, and I think it probably worked for them.
And this will, I mean, assuming they gather all the signatures, they need 117,000. What is it?
113,000.
Yeah, in that neighborhood. They'll get more to be safe. But
sure. And then it will, because some might be discounted, mm-hmm. it will show up on the ballot next year.
November 8, 2018. That's November, what they're pushing for.
2018. Okay. Ben, there's another story that you wrote this week, and I'm maybe I'll just ask you to quickly recap it before we move into our underplayed stories. And this is that there was an online database that lists disciplinary actions taken against Utah teachers. And your story was about the response of the teachers' union to try to get it taken down. What is this all about?
Yeah, so in February, this website was launched, and it puts teacher discipline. So if a teacher is guilty of some sort of misconduct and they're suspended, reprimanded, or have their license revoked, that all gets put into a filing cabinet somewhere. That filing cabinet has now been digitized.
Okay.
And so you can go on the State Board website, you can enter the name of your child's teacher, and you can see if they've ever had slaps on the wrist or their license pulled.
Oh, it doesn't necessarily say what that is for, what the disciplinary
Correct.
Action is for.
But okay. it does list any punishments that they have received. And so the union has sued the board over this website because their argument is that most teacher discipline cases are resolved through agreed settlements, like a plea deal, where instead of going through this laborious due process, the teacher says, okay, I will accept a reprimand, and this will all be over. Hmm. And the union is saying, at the time those agreements were made, this website didn't exist. So these teachers have agreed to terms that did not include the public listing of their career punishments. Yeah. And so what they're saying is, yeah, it's this, you know, we're fine with the website existing, we're okay with it moving forward as we can agree to this, but retroactively there's an issue.
Okay. Do other states have databases like this?
Yeah, it's relatively common. The creation of this website was born out of a ranking that I want to say USA Today did, where they looked at the transparency of teacher discipline. Utah got kind of dinged for not having a public database, and many states do. So it's relatively common.
I'm afraid we'll have to cut this short just because of time, but Ben Wood's story on this, like everything else that we've been discussing on the show, can be found at sltrib.com. All right, it's time to turn to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. And Ben Wood, I'll stick with you. Do you have one ready?
I do. My colleague Alex Stuckey has an article, I believe, in today's paper about John Huntsman Sr., the Tribune's owner and Utah's richest man. He's all in on medical marijuana. He's never tried it, but he says he would certainly like to, and he's okay with it.
Yeah, and he's a cancer survivor as well. They pointed that out, and he'd be interested in trying it. Robert Gerke, your underplayed story of the week.
I'm going to mention Wade Faraway, who was an assistant attorney general, passed away yesterday. He unexpectedly. This is a guy who he dealt with the legislature. He was sort of the government relations contact point for the legislature, so he had his hand in a lot of policy making. He also had an affinity for arena rock and was a big Def Leppard and Journey fan, and whenever I'd see him up at the legislature, we'd always talk about, you know, his upcoming concerts that are coming in. So he'll be missed.
Okay. And Courtney Tanner, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Our intern Taylor Stevens wrote this really interesting kind of profile of the downtown liquor store. A lot of people kind of write it off as, you know, this is where the homeless individuals go, but she kind of found the nuance there, and it's interesting.
This is the Fourth South liquor store that may or may not be moved, depending upon what happens. There are some efforts to try and get it moved. Okay, check that out at sltrip.com. Tommy Burr in Washington, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, this happened yesterday, so I don't know if you guys have seen it yet, but Mark Kasowitz, who is the President Trump's lawyer, apparently responded to a guy who emailed him saying, you should resign, you shouldn't be involved in this, with a, for the radio audience, I'll just say, screw you, was his response. But he's like, stop effing with me, I know who you are, watch your back. Again, this is the president's attorney is responding to somebody who emails him with, watch your back, I'm going to come after you, kind of thing. Sorry. He's now going to apologize, apparently.
Tommy, who was emailing him?
I don't think we know the name yet. It's some guy, let's say a Midwestern guy who emails him, said, I don't think you should be involved in this. And the president's attorney responds with this tirade against him.
Wow. Okay. Interesting pick for underplayed story. I'm going to go with, for my pick, I'm vacillating between two stories here, but I think I'm going to go with the Utah Highway Patrol having a new tool to try and catch texters, people who are texting and driving. What it is essentially is an experimental spotter van that gives officers a chance to look into your car and see whether or not you're texting and driving. And so those of you who text and drive, first off, don't do it, but also beware, there's a new tool to catch you. Guys, we have a tiny bit more time left. Anybody have one additional underplayed story of the week? Yeah, Courtney Tanner's got one.
So Lee Davidson's in court this morning on this case of the Utah United Party to kind of see if their candidate Jim Bennett can run or not in this special election to replace Chaffetz.
Okay, he's checking that out. And this is he was prevented from getting on the ballot because the party had not been certified by the time that the special election came into play. Is that an accurate portrayal?
Yeah.
I don't know. Anybody have a sense of whether or not he'll make it onto the ballot? Robert Gerke.
Well, it's an interesting case. I think they wanted to have their signatures counted provisionally, and so they could get so they could get registered before the deadline, and that's sort of where this boils down, is whether or not they had the same filing deadline as the other parties. I think the state's going to have a problem, though, because they changed the filing deadlines. The window to file for office was narrowed so we could meet these special election deadlines, and I think that's where the state's going to have a problem in trying to defend that.
Interesting. And it doesn't fit the letter of the law necessarily.
Right.
Okay, well, and he may still have time to run as an independent if he wanted to.
Yeah, you can run as a write-in or you can run as an independent if you want. I think that puts you at a significant disadvantage, but we'll see how this plays out.
Brand new third party that didn't exist 2 months ago?
Yeah, that's
good question. All right, well, Benjamin Wood, Robert Gerke, Courtney Tanner, and Tommy Burr, all from the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you very much for joining us today on Behind the Headlines.
Great, thank you. Have a good weekend.
That does it for this edition of the show. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis and Ross Chambliss here at KCPW for running the technical side of the show today. At Utah Public Radio, the broadcast is managed by Tom Williams, Spencer Halsey, Alyssa Roberts, and Christy Aachen. Thanks very much to the show's producer as well, Emily Means. For podcasts of this program, you can visit our website, kcpw.org, or download the show with whatever app you use to get your podcasts. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great weekend.